welcome to An Evening with Nirvana. It's a podcast where I talk to a series of guests from the Doom community, perhaps outside of it, about level design, map creation, and other facets of game development. Today on the podcast, I'm talking to Doomkid. He's a font of knowledge for all things Doom, YouTube content creator in his own right, and he's also creator of the Rowdy Rudy and Ray Mohawk series. You may know him for any one of these things or all of them. Welcome to the podcast, Doomkid. How are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here.
Excited, pumped, ready to get asked generic Doom questions to begin the day.
Oh man, I'm oozing with excitement.
Wow, oozing.
Excreting excitement.
Beautiful. So you've listened to the show before, you know what's coming. How did you get into Doom originally?
The first way I got into Doom was pretty much through Wolfenstein 3D, actually. When I was a little babe, my uncle, my dad's younger brother, brought over a laptop with a black and white screen. And my family was just amazed. And he was playing Wolfenstein 3D like a shareware version. And of course, a couple years later, he brought over the same laptop and it had Doom running on it. And then a year or two after that, my dad bought a shareware CD, which had 1.666 on it. And I played that so much, so intensely, that my brother went and illegally downloaded the Doom 2 bootleg. There's like a common 1.666 bootleg. That's the one that I grew up with of Doom 2. And then my dad bought the Ultimate Doom like box. And that was all by like 1999. I had all my physical Doom stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think you're one of the first people who actually played Wolf 3D before playing Doom. I think everyone else like skipped that one.
Yeah, for me, Doom was like the amazing sequel. Wolf's just like the old grandpa of Doom.
Yeah, I think I played Wolf 3D much after I played Doom.
Right.
Yeah. Do you remember, so you played 1.66, so you actually played the shareware and then played like Ultimate Doom and stuff later. Do you remember which of the IWADs was like your favorite as a kid?
I think I liked Doom 1 episode, like the first episode of Doom 1, for its sort of thematic consistency and the eeriness of the music. But overall, I kind of like Doom 2 more for its arcadiness and like the extra weapons and guns and the SSG, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And what about Final Doom? Did you play that like much later or did that come pretty soon after?
That was like in the early 2000s when I was really getting into like downloading WADs and playing WADs. I discovered Final Doom among like a collection of WADs on a website. And I just kind of like didn't even realize they were official until I started talking to people about them. But I really liked them because I was running them as just like the way you would run any Mega WAD with Doom 2. And so, but I really liked them. They were clearly like right there with, you know, Memento Mori, probably above it looking back.
Right, yeah. And I guess I was curious, having played a decent amount of your stuff, out of Plutonia and TNT, which is your pick?
Look, overall, I do like Plutonia's compact and like really thoughtful and well done level design. But I kind of like the jank factor of TNT and like the funny custom textures, and it's got really cool custom minis too. It's hard to say. It's really hard to say.
Yeah, I agree that these days for me it's more and more difficult. I think people are a little like, I love Plutonia definitely, but I think people are maybe a little rose tinted about it. I think some of the later levels are kind of rough here and there. You know, it's not perfect. Oh. And TNT isn't as bad as people think, so I think there's more of a balance between the two than people are willing to admit.
Oh yeah, I would say that Plutonia is a little bit overpraised these days, and TNT is a little bit overhated these days, for sure.
Yeah, I feel like I start every episode by apologizing for TNT. That's how I
sound. You gotta. That's one of you're one of the resident TNT apologists. You gotta keep up the crusade.
I'm doing my best. So you talked briefly about Memento Mori there. Like, what other P-Wads did you get into initially when you started downloading stuff?
Well, my very first PWADs that I found, probably in like 1999 and 2000, would have been Hellrun, Doom City, Area 51, and a handful of others.
And I know you're big into like shovelware and stuff.
Yeah, I do like shovelware. That's true.
Did you happen to play D-Zone when, like, in the 90s?
Well, funny thing about that, I didn't have the first shovelware CD I got when I was 12. I was visiting with my dad, was visiting a friend of his, and he just so happened to be a fan of Doom as well. And he gave me a shovelware disc called Doom Heaven. And so it's not exactly D-Zone, but it's the same concept. And I did get a handful of WADs that I enjoyed through that as well, for sure.
Oh yeah. And so when did you actually start like making your own stuff, like mapping?
That would have been late 2001 that I first, like, I was interested. I wanted to make Doom maps ever since I was really little, but I was too young to like really understand it. But by late 2001, I was actually getting to the point where I could understand it. Started with WAD author.
Oh wow. So the OG kind of.
Yeah, one of the early editors for sure.
Mm-hmm. And looking at the Doom Wiki, you sort of started out with like a lot of little deathmatch maps and stuff, and like moved into Skull Tag, things like that. Were you a big deathmatch fan, or did you just sort of like making maps for it?
I loved deathmatching. Even like I still deathmatch somewhat often today, but like when I was a kid, I was really hardcore into it. Like Duango 5 and 6 were, I played them way too much.
Right. Yeah, because there have been quite a few people who, like, they make a lot of deathmatch maps, but they don't actually play deathmatch. They just like the mapping experience.
To be honest, that's why most deathmatch maps out there, it's going to sound so fart sniffy, mine are not that great either, but most deathmatch maps out there, they look at, like, the, so much about them is sound from a design perspective, but they're not good for actual deathmatching, because you can tell it was made by people who don't understand like what's kind of annoying with weapon placement and getting snagged on bits of geometry that wouldn't be a problem with single player, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So what other things do you think are like design elements that should be looked out for in deathmatch that aren't necessarily as important in single player?
You know, in single player, I don't mind the presence of doors. I think they're a great way to, like, you know, wall off different, slightly different themed areas or hide an ambush. But in deathmatch, you want as few doors as possible. That's definitely like number one. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, 64 wide hallways are bad enough in single player. I wouldn't advise them there, but in deathmatch, they're just, it makes it unplayable pretty much.
Right. And you were talking about like annoying weapon placement. What kind of stuff does that involve?
So times where you have to run around with the pistol and you don't get a gun, like, and because the weapon switching in a split second thing like deathmatch, the weapon switching is already relatively slow. So having to wander for 10 seconds to get a gun, you've probably already been killed by then. But even when you get one, if it's a really lame gun, like if it's just a single barrel, or if it's something that's limited use, like the rocket launcher, but it's in a tight area, that's bad. You know, you don't want that.
Yeah.
You always got to give someone like the SSG, or at the very least, like a plasma gun or something. You want to have power right from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. So one of your like earliest single player endeavors is Doom Kid Planet.
Yeah.
Great name, by the way. It has like all the trappings, I guess, of like someone's early mapping, but I actually thought like it played pretty decently considering how long ago you made it. Do you remember like what influenced that WAD at all? Was it just sort of things like Memento Mori and like early PWADs you'd played?
I think it was the collective stew of like little graphic modifications from things like Area 51 and Doom City and some design stuff that was pretty common in like the early Z Doom scene and early Skull Tag scene. There was like people tended to make maps a little bit too cramped back then, and I felt like I did that as well. So, but yeah, there was definitely a blend of like late 90s and early 2000s influences.
Yeah, I thought the infinite pistol was kind of a nice addition. Why did you feel like the wad needed to have an infinite pistol in it?
It was kind of inspired. There's an old Super Nintendo game called Smash TV. Well, I actually was on a bunch of different consoles. And you always have an infinite weapon, an infinite ammo machine gun, no matter what, but you can pick up weapons that have a limited amount of ammo. It's nice to have a gun to always fall back on, no matter what, but it shouldn't be super powerful. I really just was inspired by Smash TV for that specific design choice.
And I thought it was kind of interesting how you can sort of see the roots of the kind of run and gun gameplay that you make now, even in this one. Do you think your sensibilities have changed much in terms of what you enjoy in Doom over the years?
Well, there's my sensibilities and what I like to make have evolved a bit. I think what I like to play, I've always enjoyed a wide variety of different things. Like, I feel at home with vanilla partial conversion-y type stuff, but I enjoy a really wide variety of mods. But as far as what I like to make, I liked to do a little bit too much realism, and I was a little bit just, I felt like I was a bit stilted early on. Whereas I kind of allowed myself to lose some of my weird little shackles and stuff when it got later in mapping, once I'd been doing it for 8 or 10 years, you
What kind of shackles do you think?
I was kind of going for, I like Doom Cute, but I was going for, there's an early WoD I made called UAC Rebellion, for example.
That's coming up.
Oh, it is? Oh, okay. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead right now. Well, the problem was I was trying to be too realistic with my design to the point where it was cramped and annoying. Like, in the same way that the Alpha, like Tom Hall wanted to do the Alpha Dooms really realistically. And I remember one of the other developers, might have been Romero, saying that the little square sort of realistic buildings were boring. And I kind of fell into that trap myself in some of my earlier WoDs.
Well, yeah, UAC Rebellion. I did like it's sort of another step up in terms of modifications and stuff. Because it's I think it changes quite a bit more than Doom Kid Planet did. Were you sort of always hoping to make these kinds of addition to Doom, and you were just building the skills to do it, in terms of dehacked and things like that, or was that just something that you wanted for UAC Rebellion specifically?
I think it's, I've always been, I think every different WoD I've made over the years has sort of like an alternate universe version of me trying to fulfill a generally similar vision, which is, that's something that gives that partial conversion feel where it still feels pretty close to Doom's gameplay, but there's a number of sprite modifications and stuff. There's a few earlier WoDs that I mentioned. They have these custom sprites and assets that really help make it feel like Doom, but an independent mod as well. And I like that. Like, I don't have anything against plain vanilla maps that only have a custom MIDI, let's say. But I really do prefer when there's just a chunk of the weapons are a little different and the textures are a little different. That hits home for me perfectly.
And for people getting into dehacked and decorate early on in their mapping, do you have any advice for ways to make it a bit easier on yourself?
Look, in the old days, a lot of people just weren't aware of WAC Ed, which is like the Windows version of dehacked. And so people were still trying to use the old DOS program to do these changes. And no, but these days as well, there's Doom Tools and DecoHack, I think it's called, by Matt Tropiano. So there's WAC Ed and DecoHack are both definitely worth looking into. They're the way to do it these days. Like, it's so much easier. The compared to the old dehacked way and or doing it through text files and stuff, it's a lot less complex.
Is DecoHack compatible with anything that will use dehacked, or does it only work with MBF21?
I'm not sure. I'm still stuck on WAC Ed, but I know I spoke to Essel a couple months ago, and she suggested looking into DecoHack, and I haven't, because this was after I had already done the Jamal Jones resources up. So next time I start working on a DHAC thing, I'm going to look into it more. And but right now I don't know, unfortunately. But I'll look into, you know what? I think she used it for knee deep in Z-Doom, actually. So yeah, that would suggest that it is vanilla compatible at this point, at least.
Well, there you go. It is really good there. It's Decorate is a much nicer like language to use than the DHAC strings.
Oh god, yeah.
So you made Toon Doom in 2010.
yeah,
you made it quite a bit after like things like Simpsons Doom and Batman Doom and stuff like that. What made you want to put like Beavis and Butthead and Mario into Doom at this point in your life?
You know what? It's funny. I would have been 18, I guess. I really liked just there was no really good Beavis and Butthead Doom out there. What's funny is it's recently, a year or two ago, Mad Butcher, who is a bit of like a Doom wad archaeologist, he rediscovered the old Beavis and Butthead Doom that got taken down from id Games by Viacom in like 1997 or 1998. And I'd seen screenshots of this Beavis and Butthead Doom mod, which was recently resurfaced. And I really liked that. And the closest thing I could do was take the sprites from the Super Nintendo version of Beavis and Butthead and rework them to be Zombie Man and Shotgunner replacements. And then after I did that, I was like, well, this feels empty. I'm just going to load the rest up with other sprite edits that I'd already found by other people and ripped from other games and stuff. Because it just felt too lonely with just Beavis and Butthead and no one else.
It is pretty funny because like I skipped around a little bit and you go to map 7 and it's like just a bunch of Mancubi, but then you open like the walls and like 30 Mega Man sprites just
tiny little like undersized Super Nintendo Mega Man sprites.
I wasn't ready for it.
So. Oh, that's so terribly done. I just like lazily ripped it from some game and didn't even rescale it or anything.
Beautiful. It's like I'm in Mega Man. It's so in like 2014, 2015, you went back to making like a lot of deathmatch content, and you also led several community projects. I was wondering what made you want to start like hosting your own projects.
Well, a funny thing about the community projects was actually something I wanted to do from very early on. I want to say 2003 or 2004. When I definitely did not have enough experience. I was just being a dumb, overenthusiastic kid who was being like, lolzors, you guys should help me with the community project. We see them nowadays, even on Doom World, like, you know, some 12-year-old gets on there and starts. I was doing that, and Tango, who you spoke to recently, he helped me out a lot with what I wanted to do. He took a really basic, just vanilla map I had made and spruced it up so much. This was really early in his mapping career, I'm pretty sure. And I really liked that, and it inspired me. But of course, I wasn't ready yet. And the whole thing was like quite a few older people came in and was like, you're clearly not ready yet. And so the thing was called Community Co-op. It wanted to be like the Pepsi to the if community chest is Coca-Cola, I wanted community co-op to be like the Pepsi, you know what I mean?
Right.
But I didn't have the experience at the time. But Tango helping me a lot kept that spark in the back of my mind. I'm like, when I am ready, I want to start hosting community projects again. So it's always the will's always been there.
Mm-hmm. So it ended up more of the Fanta, is what you're saying.
Yeah, in the end we got Fanta. That's what I
And did you find that, like, all this deathmatch mapping and, like, knowledge of deathmatch and stuff, did it have a big influence on how you tended to structure your single-player maps?
It did, for sure. I didn't even consciously realize that until somewhat recently. A friend of mine, Snaxolotl, who made Stickney installation, and she's working on Abscission now as well. She's a really good mapper. She mentioned to me that my single player maps actually just looked like big deathmatch maps that had been like slightly reworked for single player. And she's like, I don't mean that as an insult. Like they're, you know, architecturally sound and they look good and, you know, look good enough and everything. But when she pointed that out to me, I looked and I'm like, wow, they are pretty like round and they always tend to loop back on themselves and you can access areas from a few different passages. Stuff like that translates from my deathmatch mapping as single player. Unconscious, I didn't even, you know, I'm not even really thinking of it in that way. Mm-hmm.
And how useful do you think like joining community projects is for new mappers in terms of building skills?
Oh, it's a really great way for them to, if the community project is focused on like, you know, there's no barrier for entry, or at least very little barrier for entry. It's the idea is to encourage newer and less experienced people. Those are great because I get other people's feedback on what they liked and what they didn't. And if you agree with it, you can incorporate it in. And it's a great way to get a bunch of mappers in one circle. If they all started their own individual threads where they released these maps, they might get one or two comments and not much. But because they're all working on this community project together, there's a bunch of collective eyes on these maps to like look over them and make sure everyone's getting notes on their maps and stuff. So it's really useful. I definitely think it's a very... Mm-hmm. And the community is really like friendly and welcoming, generally speaking. So that helps too.
Yeah. I do think also like with community projects these days, you're probably more likely for like, I don't know, like a streamer or someone on YouTube or, you know, someone to pick it up and play it than if you just make a single map.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Decino playing through the Doom and Doom 2 the way I remember. That's a good example of that, I'd say. Hmm.
No, I mean, not that your goal should be to get streamers to play your stuff, but
no, of course not.
Just in terms of getting feedback and stuff.
Oh yeah, of course. It always helps. The more people you get feedback from, the more you can take in. It's also, but of course, you know, that's the thing. It's not about getting eyes on it necessarily, but it just helps, especially when you're in that learning phase. I was pretty lucky. I always, from square one, when I started posting maps publicly, I always got quite a few people commenting on them, which helped a lot over time, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I was lucky too, because I already knew a few people. Like, I had quite a few people who were, like, starting to make... Because I think Bemuse and Benjo, they were already making... They'd already made a couple of things, but we were starting to release things at a similar time. And I think maybe Zold too, so a lot of us were, like, building maps at the same time, and then we could just ask each other to playtest and stuff, so we had some internal like playtesting going on already. But I think if you don't know people in the community or like fresh to it, then feedback is like super crucial. So community projects can be like just a really good way to get something out there and actually get it tested.
That's true. And in a lot of cases it might end up in people meeting and then becoming friends, or they start talking on Discord, or back in the day, of course, it was like IRC and TeamSpeak. But it's a good way to network, because then once you get a group of people together like that, you can get crews. Like, I've got a few different people who regularly sign up to my community projects to the point where they're associated with my stuff, or I'm associated with their stuff. You know, it's cool. I like that. And I've seen like the Squonker crew, for example. They're another good crew of people who came together through the community and stuff like that. And so they end through participating in other things, you can get a crew built for which, and then that crew can help not only make other things, but give you feedback on your own work. It's a good system. It's a good way. Those community projects can be a good way to get people, you know, networking for mappers and feedback and all that kind of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. I think maybe we need crew battles in Doom. Everyone needs to have a crew. And yeah, and we fight it out with maps.
Dude, just like that's what it was in the old days with the old multiplayer clan tags. People would talk crap. Everyone's like, we'll do a team deathmatch against each other. That'll show, you know, to determine who's the winner. But yeah, no, that would be fun to see that happening as well, with like single player mapping crews going toe to toe. That's a funny concept, man.
Oh yeah, I mean, well, Archie was saying the Russian community sort of had that, but they weren't super competitive. I guess they were just like some sort of groups of mappers that had like a name and stuff that would contribute to things.
Yeah, that's cool. It is good to have different good to see more and more mapping crews spring up. I think the more the merrier. And it would be fun to have, like, you know, tongue-in-cheek competitiveness between them.
Yeah, I think so. I can bring back my old Halo 2 clan. It's going to be great.
What was it called?
It was called the Russian Army. I think there were like 100 people in it or something.
Nice.
We used to play Tower of Power all the time. That was like the big event. We had this one guy. He never used his mic, but Halo used to have proximity voice. So when someone was close to you, you could hear people talking. So this guy never used his mic, and he just listened to really hardcore techno all the time. And you could hear it blasting through his mic. So you could always hear him coming.
Dude, I love it. In the game, I always think of stuff like that in the game, like, he's just got that music blast. Like, whenever the other, like, Marines are running near him, they're like, oh, yeah, there he is blasting that techno music again. That's just hilarious to me.
That's so good. It just made him into this, like, character in the group.
He was part of the Russian army?
He was, yeah. He was part of the clan.
I really like... I've always liked Unidoom. They're, like, probably the oldest... I mean, you know, there's not a whole lot of actual multiplayer Doom clan activity these days. There's a little bit still, but it's not what it was in the old days. But Unidoom has been around since like 1998. Ralphus started it. He's still around. He's a community staple, of course. I was lucky, like eight years ago, I think it was now, I did a little dual initiation to join up. I just thought, it's like, you know what, Unidoom is probably the most prestigious Doom clan, even though clan activity is pretty much a thing of the past anyway. I really want to get in there and be part of the crew, just because I really love the Unidoom Deathmatch WoTs so much, man. They're so good.
Well, yeah, I think we're bringing it back with this podcast. The clans are back.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's time for the resurgence.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so to move away from clans, as important as it is to discuss, what made you want to join THT Threnody as a contributor?
Really, it's Ty is just... His custom title is no lie. You know, he really is an essential pillar of the community. And, you know, whenever he died, it was really sad. You know, there's a... I don't want to get too much into negative bullshit, but there was a wave of people actually, like, trying to discredit Ty. I remember there was a thing where someone, like, impersonated him and was saying weird crap. I don't remember the specifics of it, but it was you know, it was really frustrating. And then a year to, like, they were trying to bombard the archive with junk files and stuff like that as well. Mm-hmm. Just to bother Ty, like, it was seemed to be targeted at Ty specifically, which was really frustrating. And then a year or two later, he ended up dying, and it just all, the whole thing felt bad. I was like, you know what, Ty is such a great force for Doom. Always really nice to interact with. So, yeah, when THT was announced, I thought it was a great thing, and I definitely wanted to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do to sort of try and emulate, like, his style and stuff? What did you look at specifically?
Well, to be perfectly honest, all I did was I tried to emulate just a generalized TNT-ish style. I didn't necessarily specifically emulate anything of Ty's style, but I will say that things that I did to try and make it feel TNT-ish were like probably my worst but also most TNT-ish map in that WoD would be Forgotten Reaches, and it has like some weird, like, the use of that what's it called, rock red glowing texture that's like cut away, and there's a secret soul sphere or something behind it. Mm-hmm. And just really like sort of 128 hall, I said hall, 128 tall halls, and which is really, you know, that's obvious, like everything's 128 units high by default, so it's like lazy to leave it at that height, but mm-hmm. I kind of wanted to emulate the sort of 90s janky feel with chunks of that map, so that was different ways that I TNT-ified it slightly, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're going to make something TNT related, it's got to have, like, at least one gigantic area that's completely pointless.
Yeah, yeah. I had a huge room that was devoid of much. There's a few enemies wandering around, but it was devoid of much. And then there was a 128 unit tall room with a bunch of grates that were just kind of, I liked the way it looked, but it was really like annoying to actually play through. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's I TNT. Probably should have made it a bit better, but it did. It was TNT-ish, you know? Mm-hmm.
Atmosphere is good. Looks interesting, but usually kind of bad to play. That's the TNT experience.
Yep, that's right.
I noticed that you made a MIDI for the Revolution MIDI pack. Was this like one of your earliest forays into MIDI making?
No, you know what? This was actually a later one, but the track kind of got compromised a little bit just because it didn't fit in its original form. Like, I think as a MIDI file, it was better in its original form because it was a bit heavier and lower pitch. A redone version that was helped with me by Tristan, you know, who used to go by Eris, of course, was actually featured in Akeldama, funny enough. But the original, it kind of was like, I had to make it, I think I pitched it up a key or two and changed a few instruments. And it just came out kind of like plonky and bouncy and weird. Like it was a little bit catchy still, but it was just, I didn't like it. It was meant to be heavy and slow. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And the Akeldama version really captured what I was actually going for with that song.
Right. You tend to like make a lot of covers on your YouTube channel. Is this part of, I guess I think of you as like a sort of nostalgia driven mapper. Like there's a lot of shovelware influence and 90s influence and stuff. Do you think that is sort of where the covers come from as well?
You know, the MIDI remakes, I'm basically doing those because, for one thing, I spent so long going through many different deathmatch and single player WODs that were from the shovelware, even if they were on shovelware discs, they're just from the 90s stuff uploaded on GeoCities and stuff like that. And they would have cool MIDIs, or at least MIDIs that were like 90% of the way to being cool, but it would have, let's say it was a Metallica MIDI. They'd have the James Hetfield vocal be like a pan flute that's like two octaves too high. Yeah. So where James Hetfield would be in a lower register, it's going tweet, 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 tweet. And I would take those MIDIs and take the drums and usually change them to power drums, or at least make them a little bit more full, add some reverb, and pitch down a few things or add like layer things that weren't layered before to fill out the MIDI a lot. To give people who are mapping now who are like, I want to use an Alice in Chains MIDI or I want to use a Metallica MIDI, which is a very 90s-ish thing to do. But for the people who do want to do that, I'm trying to give them a more enhanced version of the songs than the crappy versions that I always heard back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've definitely noticed that too, where a lot of those older MIDIs, it's exactly what you say, like they almost sound good. But then there is like literally one instrument that just makes no sense.
Yeah, yeah. It's way too high, or they picked a very dumb instrument. I know there's a Nirvana one where everything's harpsichords and it's just perfect. Funny.
There is I think they actually used a harpsichord for.
Oh, I mentioned Nirvana. No pun intended, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. I was just thinking about, I think MTV Unplugged, they used one for. It was just an accordion, actually. They did a cover of Jesus Don't Want Me for a Sunbeam.
Oh, yeah. No, that would have been cool. See, their version of it would have been cool. But taking Smells Like Teen Spirit and turning all the instruments into harpsichords and turning the drums into these weird smashy versions. Like, it's like, man, if I edit this for 1 hour approximately, it'll sound far better. So I'm going to do it.
Yeah, I remember there's a Daft Punk MIDI out there. I can't remember what it is. Maybe One More Time. But it just has this instrument that just sounds like a salt shaker. Like,
this is a pretty infamous one, but it's that Skrillex song. I can't remember what it's called, but there's a MIDI version, and there's supposed to be a drop that goes like, pew! But the drop in the MIDI version is like, whang! Like, it sounds like an old car horn.
Right. Yeah. Well. Some improvements could be made.
Yeah.
For sure. So you're doing God's work on the YouTube channel.
Yeah, for those who like those old MIDI files, but slightly better.
I wanted to talk a little bit about like weapon mods in general. You've made a few over the years. You made like power gun and super power guns, and like you tend to change your weapons up a decent amount in your wards. What are like your usual goals with a weapon mod, do you think?
An underlying theme always with them is at least souping the power up a little bit. Like I dial my powering up to various degrees. Sometimes it's like, let's say, the power dial is at zero on the default Doom weapons. I mean, that's not actually true. They feel great to use, but let's just say for this, sometimes I just dial it up to like one for something like Ray Mohawk, or I'll dial it up to two for Rowdy Rudy One. But then I want to dial it up to 10 with like super power guns or Ray Mohawk 2. And that's always the goal. It's just varying degrees of powering it up. But I don't want them to feel like clones of each other either. I try to make them feel a little bit different from iteration to iteration.
And you tend to work on like sort of balancing the weapons, I guess, or you mostly contend just sort of buffing it up based on feel.
I try now. There's time like I sometimes I succeed and sometimes I fail, but I always try to make sure there's no gun that's ever just useless. Like I want every gun to still have a use and to be reasonably balanced in terms of power. Some are better than others, but I want them to all have their uses. If any gun is useless, I feel like I've done a bad job, and I don't think that's true in most of them, thankfully.
I talked to Tango recently, and he was talking about how he thinks weapon mods should come packaged with maps that show them off, sort of like Paradise. You tend like you've made a couple of weapon mods that sort of are standalone add-ons, but a lot of the time they're sort of bundled in with your wads. Do you sort of agree that it's better to have like a showcase for a weapon mod?
I do agree, because it kind of teaches you, like, I mean, obviously it's not a mod, but Doom itself, like let's say E1 or Doom 2 or whatever, teaches you why those guns are good and how they're good and in what situations they're good naturally through playing. And so to have at least like a small handful, it doesn't have to be a full episode, but like at least three or four little maps just to demonstrate the different modifications you've made to the gameplay loop, basically, is always a good thing. I do things like there's a few times where I haven't done this, but ideally I would make a standalone weapon mod version. Excuse me, I need a drink real quick. And make a standalone weapon mod version of every different community project and thing I've ever run, because I like people to be able to use those as a base for their own map sets and stuff. But yeah, I generally agree with this theory that a map set to show it off is always for the best.
And with so with Rowdy Rudy's Revenge, what were you sort of looking to do with this project? I feel like you'd had similar projects gameplay wise in the past, at least in terms of like the run and gun sort of style, but what were you hoping to kind of push further, I guess, with Rowdy Rudy?
I always. There was always a slight story slash protagonist element to UAC Rebellion, but I really wanted to get back to having like a sort of fun character and icon to like represent. Because I feel that way about like BJ and Wolf and Doom Guy in Doom and Duke Nukem and Duke 3D and so on. And I wanted to have another sort of fun macho character like that. And so Rowdy Rudy came to be. And it was definitely a little bit more story driven. It was not like there's a huge story or anything, but it had a little bit more narrative and a little bit more character and thematic consistency, I think, than the stuff I'd made prior to that.
And yeah, sort of, I guess, as I said, like the gameplay does fit your older style, but it seems a little bit more refined in terms of things like progression and like a more, I guess, like a more linear difficulty curve, I felt. Were those things that you sort of thought about specifically when making the one?
Definitely to some degree. I wanted to. I tried replaying before I made that. I tried replaying a few of my older wads to see what worked and what didn't. And there's a wad I made, for example, called The Devil's Work, that had a few stilted. Like the player felt underpowered, and it's there's certain times, like for example, early in episode 4. E4M1 and E4M2 are fun because the player feels kind of under-equipped for the challenge. That can be really great in its own right, but I definitely go for more of the power trip angle. And so I didn't like how in the Devil's Work the player felt overwhelmed a lot of the time and had just small weapons to take on big enemies. So I definitely wanted to move away from that because to me it felt very stilted when I was playing it. And so with Rowdy Rudy, the slight buff in some of the guns combined with better placement of the guns and better placement of the enemies and slightly more open and easy to understand layouts, I think definitely contributed a lot to that one being better than the stuff that came before it.
Mm-hmm. And you talked about the story being sort of kind of fundamental to it, at least in terms of like the theming and stuff. Do you kind of wish that more WoDs attempted to have like a bit of a story, even if they're not all that in depth?
I do. And I like a character to go with it too. Like Tarnsman made Tarnsman's Projectile Hell, which was really cool. It was cool to have a central new character. I can't remember what the character's name was, but it was cool to have the Doom Girl there, you know what I mean? And I really liked that about it. And there was, like, of course, the storyline was there, but it was all just fun and silly. Like, mine are pretty just fun and silly as well. But I do like it. I feel like it adds a lot of... It makes the WoD a lot more memorable looking back for me. Because then it's not just relying on a couple of cool scenes or a couple of really memorable combat exchanges. It also has those custom graphics and that custom character to really cement it in your mind as its own thing, you know? And I love that. I would love to see more of that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I think maybe it's sort of influenced by Carmack and his opinions on story and the fact that obviously Doom didn't have much of a story to begin with, but I think people are maybe a little afraid to be, like, earnest with a story in Doom, because, I mean, obviously people often just skip through the text or whatever, or it's not really taken very seriously, but I kind of like it when someone tries to put, like, some effort into story.
Yeah, I like that too. Like, a completely throwaway silly story can be fun, and often also still is better than nothing, in my opinion, but I do like it, like, it can still be silly and fun, but I like to make sure there's at least some sort of like logic and some sort of something about it that's real, you know what I mean? So to speak, earnest is a good word for it.
Yeah. So Rowdy Rudy 2 rolls around. When did you decide you wanted to make a sequel, first of all?
Look, I was making Ray Mohawk, the first one, and I was like, look, I got two little single player episodes here. I want to do community projects. It's been a while. My last community project before that was Doomed in Space. I was ready to do it again. And that was what it was. I decided I was ready for community involvement. And plus I knew that if I gave these really powerful weapons, that's what I always do. I usually provide like two or three demonstration maps. I did that with Rowdy Rudy 2 and Ray 2. Because I knew that people could take these superpowered guns that they might not even use as a standalone mod, or they might not play a mod that was just like someone's single player thing. But no, if you make a community project of it and you're like, I'm going to show you this toolkit and I want you to run wild with it. I really wanted to do that. That way of running a community project really had some fundamental appeal to me.
Mm-hmm. And I guess what were you kind of expecting in terms of like were you hoping to sort of improve on the formula a little bit with Rowdy Rudy 2?
The formula of Rudy 1, definitely. Like I'd already noticed, even though I thought it was better than, like, I was still stepping up slowly but surely in terms of my opinion of the quality of my work, but Rudy 2 was definitely an improvement. Like, the little bit of extra beef to the guns, a little bit of extra customization in terms of enemy behavior, slightly longer and more thought-out story. Like, it was probably twice as long as Rudy 1's story. All that, I think, contributed to it being a step up in general. And that was, like, my goal. And having all the different mapper influences, because for me, at least now, great mappers, truly great mappers, won't necessarily fall into this trapping. But for me, my own style back to back to back, it can carry it. Like I can carry the show, so to speak. But I yearn for something that I don't put in my own maps. And so I get a lot of that. The community submissions, honestly, there's been very few maps I've had to say no to as well, as a side note. But that extra injection of different opinions on mapping, different perspectives coming through, that was really what I wanted. I think it paid off because I think both the community projects are better than their single player beta versions, so to speak.
Right. I guess I was wondering, like, due to the kind of like the nature of the gameplay you make, I'm curious how you tend to play the game yourself. Do you usually like run past monsters, kill them as you go, or are you like slow and methodical?
I will try to kill pretty much everything I see. I wouldn't say I'm slow and methodical, but I just at a moderate pace, I'll like sort of charge through and try to kill everything I see. But if it gets into a pickle, if I die a couple times at a certain spot, then I'll try running ahead instead to see if I can't like gather up ammo and stuff and then come back and deal with it later. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, especially if there's like an archvile you run past. I mean, you're just, you know, it goes and resurrects everything and you're screwed. But I'll try the, you know, kill everything at a steady pace approach. And if that doesn't work, I'll try to run ahead and collect stuff. And if that doesn't work, usually the map, I'll keep at it until I get it. But the map is at that point above my skill level, generally speaking.
Right. Where would you say you sort of cap out? Like, what's the hardest thing you've played?
The hardest thing that I played, not necessarily that I could finish, because there's stuff that I can beat, but the hardest thing I played and still enjoyed any harder, I think would not be that fun, would be some of the harder maps in Alien Vendetta, which I have a single player playthrough that I need to do in its entirety, which I haven't completed. I left it on hold for like 6 months. But I have played all the maps multiple times in co-op servers, sometimes just me alone in a co-op server, hoping someone would join and they did or didn't. But I've played every Alien Vendetta map, and I would say that they're like the upper level of where I still feel happy with the playing. Anything harder would be too hard for me. Not too hard to beat necessarily. I could beat it, but I feel like I'm grinding, you know, and it makes it less fun for me.
Yeah, I think it's important to know when things stop being fun. I think I will play things even when they're not fun, though, to be fair.
You know, it's funny, though, because some people, their fun is playing things that are beyond the ceiling of what's fun. It's a weird, like, paradox, but I've definitely known some doomers and people out there who the way that they enjoy the game is by going above what they can actually enjoy.
I think if your goal is to improve, then sometimes you do have to do that a little bit.
For sure.
But I do think, I don't know, there are ways to improve and then there are ways you're not going to improve. Like, I do think if you're just slamming your head into a wall, spamming saves or whatever to get through a section, you're probably not getting any better at the game, I would suggest.
No. If you're saving more often than, like, every few minutes, you're not. You've reached the point of, you know what I mean?
I would say, like, find something difficult that you can do saveless. And then that is going to make you improve the fastest.
That's right. Because you'll die a few times on each map, then you'll get that run done. But it won't be so many times that you're just totally beat. You know what I mean? That's a good way to do it. I would agree. And I actually, with my ambient, for lack of a better word, my ambient single player Doom skill, I've been content with that for a few years now. But deathmatch is a different story. I prefer to play against people who are slightly better than me because it makes me have to think quicker and react quicker and adapt quicker. Now, that's when I want. Sometimes it's fun to just play against people who are, you know, roughly in your skill level and just have a relaxed group. Sorry, what was that?
Or way worse sometimes.
Oh, God, yeah. There's times where you're just done. You know, if someone's really terrible and I'm in a pub server, I will, like, make an effort not to shoot them as much. Just so they can get a few frags in and not feel totally left out. But when it's one-on-one, though, and I'm actually like, I want to get some hard Doom, and I'm craving a challenge in Doom right now, I usually go to multiplayer Doom for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do think, yeah, with anything competitive, I think you want to play with people who are a bit better than you. It's definitely the fastest way to improve. Ray Mohawk, it's pretty similar to Rowdy Rudy in a lot of ways, but I think it like takes the theming a little bit further, I would say, and maybe the humor as well. I was wondering like what you were going for in terms of like the MIDI selection and like the overall humor of the wood for Ray Mohawk.
Well, it's funny because Rudy was still like lighthearted to a degree and tongue in cheek to a degree, but it wasn't funny. With Ray, I wanted something. It was really summery here in Australia, as you know, of course. And so, and it was right around Christmas time. I was just in a good mood. So I wanted to make some little like lighthearted popcorn maps with, you know, like I was listening to like lighthearted, like, you know, 60s rock and stuff. And I wanted to translate that vibe that I was feeling in my room, listening to that music, looking out at a bright sunshiny day or walking down to the beach or whatever. I wanted to recreate that exact vibe in a little small, like, you know, E1-esque bite-sized little episode. So yeah, that's what it was. I didn't have quite as much. I think Rudy is still fun. There's more of a fun-loving sort of atmosphere in Rudy, or in Ray 1, rather, sorry. Mm-hmm. And I think I wanted to make it a little, I wanted to add a few like references and jokes too, just to keep the mood light. Excuse me.
And I guess like, what were you, was that sort of the main thing you think that you were trying to do to differentiate it from Rudy?
Yeah, I would say the main difference is, obviously I was trying to make, you know, I'd learned a little, there wasn't that much time between the Rudy maps and the Ray maps really, but I did try to improve on a few little flaws I found with Rudy one. But beyond that, it was also definitely wanted to be a little more like light and boppy and just something that makes, if you're in the right mood, something that puts a smile on your face, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And what was the build time like for Ray Mohawk maps? Was it sort of comparable to your usual work?
Yeah, I think Ray won the entire project. I think it was like 4 or 5 just sort of casual months, or maybe 4 months of just casual working on it. You know what I mean?
Hmm. And do you tend to like speed map during projects, or do you just sort of build at your own pace?
I build briskly, but I wouldn't say I'd go at speed map. Like I try to detail a little bit as I go and fill up a little bit as I go. But then I'd try to refine the whole thing after it's done, quote unquote. I'll go and like, you know, reshape a few rooms, fix a few things up. But I try to go at brisk. I wouldn't call it speed mapping pace, but it's definitely brisk. And I know other people mull over their maps and really perfect them. I don't do that. I improve them to the point where it's like, this is a pretty darn good map. And then I move on. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That can definitely be for the best. Although I say this as the person who meticulously goes over the map 5,000 times, so.
Well, look, you're working on one really, really beautiful souffle, and I'm just churning out popcorn. So both approaches are valid. Sometimes you want to munch popcorn. Sometimes you want a really beautiful piece of Doom craft that has had a lot of thought and mulling over done. You know what I mean?
I think the experiences can be equivalently enjoyable for sure. Like I've played a lot of speed mapping projects that are just as fun as, you know, things that have clearly taken a lot of time.
That's right. So you're in the mood for some Doom popcorn, or you're in the mood for some Doom gourmet dish?
Yeah, that gourmet.
Doom. Gourmet, yeah, Doom gourmet, that's right.
So Ray Mohawk 2, I think it feels like, to me, like the most fully realized of your projects in terms of your style of gameplay and the general aesthetic. I think like the community aspect sort of maybe helped like with fleshing it out, but also like I think the weapon balancing felt the best for it. What did you do specifically to make this iteration feel like a like faster paced and sort of nicer to move through the monsters and stuff?
Well, you know, Mount Payne would say stop. He would say stop saying this, Doomkitten, if you heard me saying this, but he is somewhat to credit for the little spark that got me working on Ray Mohawk 2's specific take on weapon balance. He made an offhand remark that I have a tendency where people can make offhand remarks in Doom reviews, usually positive, but sometimes negative too. And he said that he loved Rudy 2's weapons. He said that chain gun was, you know, fun and powerful. He said, but nothing can top Valiant's chain gun. And when he said that, I was like, okay. all right, I got to like go balls to the wall with the weapon strength in this thing. And then from that spark led to me actually like working more seriously on trying to get it balanced and fun to clear through enemies that way. But it all started from, I already wanted to make a Ray 2 community project, but it was originally going to be more traditional in terms of the weapons and the monsters. But I went for the like slaughter light with ultra powered guns. Mm-hmm. That was sparked on by Mount Payne saying that he wished Rowdy 2's chain gun was as good as Valiant's, basically.
I think it's kind of a fun concept because obviously, like, I play slaughter stuff and I play it vanilla, but a lot of people play, they will like load up, what's the cool mod that the kids are playing these days?
Oh, God, I don't know. If I say Real Guns Advanced, all people are gonna be like, what the fuck? That's from like 2010.
Boot up Super Weps 1, packaged with D-Hex when it originally came out. They're gonna boot that bad boy up.
Weps 1, like it's not even 8, just 1.
That was the only one I ever played because it literally came with our copy of D-Hex. It came with Super Weps bundled in.
Was that, how did you get, was that on a copy of a shareware disc or a shovelware disc rather, or through the internet?
Yeah, it must have been, I don't know, it must have been like a magazine or something, maybe something like that. I'm really not sure. I'm not sure how we got it, but because I was a kid, so I didn't know where these things came from. I just played them kind of
thing. right, yeah.
But yeah, it was the DOS version of D-Hacked. So that was the interface that I was used to, which once you got used to it wasn't actually that bad, but there were a lot of like, there would just be like a whole section that was just question marks and like you had no idea what any of that shit did.
The one that came with Super Weps 1, so that must have been like an ancient primordial, like even D-Hacked itself, the DOS version, got way more refined and better after that point. So you were using like the primordial ooze of the DOS version of D-Hacked.
I think so, yeah. I believe so. But figured out how to do some stuff with it somehow.
That's great. That's, it would have been fun to me. I remember finding little tools like that. I had one that can mess with your save games. Like it could, like if you put a save game into it, it could replace all the enemy types with another enemy type or something like that when you reloaded it. So I love messing with things like that.
Yeah, I feel like that's much more common with like RPGs and stuff, like save state editing.
Yeah. It's weird. There's like one or two save game editors I remember for Doom, and that was it. It kind of went away as a concept, especially after Source Ports, because they all use their own formats.
Yeah, we had, I think this came packaged with D-Zone, actually. It was like a randomizer for enemies. You would be able to, like, I don't know. You'd usually end up with, like, 50 stuck Spider Masterminds somewhere or something.
Yeah, a bunch of Spider Masterminds clogging up E1, M1. Oh, this is the pinnacle of gameplay.
Yeah. And we had that, and D-Hacked with Super Weps 1, and then we had DoomCAD 95, that was the editor that I used originally.
Wow, DoomCAD, you know what? Before I found Wintex, I used DoomCAD to merge, like I would make single levels and I would merge them using DoomCAD. That's the only thing I ever used it for, but I do have some nostalgia for it for that.
Truly horrible program, but
to map with.
It was so bad, dude. You can't even imagine. If you built a big map in it and you, I mean, I've talked about this 100 times on the podcast with other people, so skip this if you've listened to the podcast. I just really love talking about how shit DoomCAD 95 was for the kids who come in using Doom Builder and think it's difficult.
Right. Oh, dude. Doom Builder. Dude. Oh, my God. That's easy street.
DoomCAD 95, some of the limitations, you always had to draw clockwise. If you wanted like a proper sector, if you wanted like a pillar in the middle of a room, you drew counterclockwise. If you wanted a sector within a sector, you would draw the sector clockwise, obviously within your sector, but then you had to go over it again with another tool. So you would select the outer sector and then draw over the inner sector to make it like part of that sector kind of thing.
That's so fucked up. So when you would draw it clock, it could only, face the line desk. Like, you know how the line desks have like a front and a back side. You can only put the front side clockwise. Like, the way you draw it should not impact whether or not the line def is facing front or back. That is so shitty. Oh man, that is hard. Wad Author would have been a breeze compared to that. Oh god.
Well, technically Doom Builder is the same in that if you draw clockwise, they will be facing inwards, I believe. Yeah. And then if you draw counterclockwise, it's outwards. But if you did that in DoomCAD, so if you drew it counterclockwise, you would get void space in the middle, and it wouldn't be a sector.
Yeah, that's crappy. Like, the fact that it wouldn't automatically set things to still be functional, that's so terrible. Yeah. Because with Doom, it usually doesn't matter. Like, in Doom Builder, even, like, when you're making a space, even if you want to make a column, I usually just select the sector and then delete it. So, and then it automatically flips the line defs, of course. It's great. See, people don't realize there's so many of these little like optimizations. The editors have gotten smarter and smarter over the years. Mm-hmm. And just through little changes like that can make a huge difference. I know for sure. With Wad Author, you had to you would spawn a new sector into existence and you would specify the number of sides it had. And so if you wanted a circle, you would be like, make a new 32-sided thing. And then you would say like, you would specify the diameter of it, but you could just put in four sides and say diameter of 128 and bam, you get a 128 by 128 square. But it was weird. Like then you could add in vertexes and reshape it, and you could add as many vertexes as you want. So you weren't limited to that number, but it was just a great way of making perfect circles. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, it was really weird. But no one thought of just drawing the lines for some reason until Deep Sea. Yeah.
Well, DoomCAD 95 was, you drew the lines. You did. It worked technically the same as Doom Builder. Although I think it was all left click drawing. I can't remember. It was different. Also, if you deleted a line def, it would crash pretty much every time. You couldn't delete line defs. You couldn't delete... I think maybe sometimes... No. You couldn't delete a sector either. So you couldn't delete lines or sectors. You couldn't copy and paste for the most part or it would crash.
Oh my god. The pinnacle of usability.
And if you... When you wanted to save a map, it would draw the nodes. Like, you would watch it draw the nodes for you, basically. Which was kind of cool visually, but it used to take a long time. So, if you made a really big map, it could take, like, an hour to draw the nodes on our, like, 486 or whatever. And then it might just crash while it was doing it. And then, because it hadn't actually saved, you would just lose everything that you'd made. So... That's really good.
God. So do you remember when you were, do you remember like roughly what year this was? I asked because like what operating system were you running at the time?
Well, the thing was I used this when, it probably would have been like Windows 98 when I was using it as a kid. And then I used it for a long time when it was like definitely obsolete. Because I think I tried to get Deep Sea, but you used to have to pay for it, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
So I didn't. Because I was like, wow, this looks a lot better. But yeah, obviously I wasn't going to pay for it. So it wasn't until I got the next editor I got. Because I guess I took like a bit of a hiatus from Doom and then I came back. And I got Doom Builder 2, I believe. Because I'd seen people using Doom Builder 1. And I got that. And then I realized Doom Builder 2 was already out. So I ended up getting that. And that's when I started to map again. I was like, holy shit, this is so much better. Like, I couldn't fathom that you could do the things in Doom Builder 2 that you could do, because Doom 95 was so horrible.
It's funny because Doom Builder 2 now is so limited compared to GZ Doom Builder, which is starting to get limited compared to Ultimate Doom. It's the chain of editors evolving and getting better still continues to this day. Because it's funny because I was using Doom Builder 1 until like 2017. I was like, it does everything I need it to do. And then Dragonfly was like, no, dude. And he showed me that you could draw sectors right over top of each other and it would automatically, like, you had to draw sectors to shape still in Doom Builder 1. You could draw sectors over top of each other with no problem in GZ Doom Builder and Ultimate Doom Builder. I'm like, wow, now we've really entered the phase of like anyone can do this no matter what. Like even people who don't understand how sectors work can just draw them over top of each other and it just goes boom and automatically fixes it all up for you. Oh, it's like space age technology compared to what we were dealing with back then.
Yeah, dude. I mean, now you can select something, stair build a tool, add like 15 sectors, and then take that whole thing, copy it, scale it up by 75%, flip it, paste it over the top of what you just made, and all the lines will just connect. That's crazy.
It is. It makes geometry, like, if you want to add some craters, but then like put another water sector in the middle of the craters, rather than having to redraw them all by hand, just select them all, shrink them down a bit, boom, you're all sorted. Like, it's just... These young mappers, they don't understand how easy they have it.
This is why I complain about other people now. The horrors.
Dude, I'm the same way. I gotta get the old 90s and early 2000s pains. The younger doomers need to know about them.
Mm-hmm. Some kind of mountain of pain. 27. You know. But back to Ray Mohawk, which is what we were talking before this divergence in the conversation. I was wondering how much work went into sort of getting the weapons to feel right for that, because I do feel like I was saying earlier, I think it's like it feels the best for me in terms of like your wards when it comes to like being able to like push through packs of enemies and the enemy balance to weapon balance, I suppose.
So the way that I worked on that was I had this there's map, what became map one, there was just a small chunk of that that was like a testing area. There's an area that's like an outcrop on a beach that's like three sort of round things on this building. And that was it. That room was all that existed. But I was filling that room up with like imps and then seeing how the weapons, like I was trying to do little tweaks in WackEd to the like tick rate and to the frames and all that stuff. And then I would fill this little area up with imps, see how all the weapons felt against imps. Then I'd fill it up with Hell Knights, see how it felt against them. Put a handful of Archviles, see how it felt against them. I really worked harder on trying to see how every weapon felt against every enemy than I did, even in Rudy 2. I did a degree of that in Rudy 2, but not as thoroughly.
Mm-hmm. And it's sort of a common theme throughout your stuff to have like a really powerful fist weapon. Why do you want the fist to be so powerful?
So the Berserk concept alone, I played Doom for a couple years before I think I even picked up a Berserk kit, because I had just had this shareware disc for the first while of playing. And when I first found a Berserk kit and punched and it just splattered, I was like, whoa, this turns the fist from the lame thing into like something amazing. So I basically, just because I love that sensation so much, I want to give an even more amped up version of that. Not to mention RD. I did it in a WOD before I had done it quite as much. I did it in a WOD and RD said, wow, that feels satisfying. And another speedrunner named Demon12321, he also liked it. And because a few people commented on they really liked that powerful fist, I was like, yeah, that's a good thing. You know, when you run out of ammo, you can fall back on something that's still really useful to take these demons out.
Yeah. I feel like I did fall back on the fist quite a lot because it's extremely overpowered. That one.
Yeah, you can. In Ray 1, I did it almost as for like comedy. Like, I made it comically overpowered compared to the other guns. Whereas in like Rudy 1, it's just it's a solid weapon that's usable. And in Ray 2, compared to the other stuff, it's a solid weapon that's usable. And in Ray 1, relative to what's actually going on, it was kind of like almost a joke. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. I did want to ask, like, you have mentioned him a couple of times now. And you do make a lot of content with Mount Pain 27. I was wondering how like the two of you became friends initially.
Well, what's funny is probably I didn't see him directly through Decino making a post about him, but Mount Pain had like, I think he had two or three reviews. I think it was only two reviews posted on his channel, and he got recommended to me because I think each of the video had over 1,000 views, so it was getting done. Big enough to where YouTube would recommend it to people who are interested in Classic Doom already. Mm-hmm. And I watched his first two videos, I really liked them. But, you know, there was the audio was slightly scratchy or whatever, but the formula was great. And I commented and like left thoughtful comments. And then he ended up playing some of my maps after looking at my channel when I commented on there. And then he left a comment or two on my channel. And then we just started talking. And then from there, we just hung out more and more. And we became friends like maybe 6 to 8 months after. It was really whenever he did his Memento Mori episode. That was really what started us hanging out regularly.
Right, yeah. Because I've noticed you have done like quite a lot of... You've done playthrough, like you've done Plutonia playthrough where Mount Pain isn't actually playing the game with you. He just sits there and kind of, I don't want to say mocks you, but he just sort of makes comments on the side.
He's doing like the MST 3K. He's sitting in the theater, like judging me as I play, basically. Yeah,
yeah. It's definitely an interesting idea. Maybe content that it, like, I had considered as well. Just there's something funny about somebody watching you play. The added pressure, I don't know what it is, but I think it actively makes you play worse, and then you know, you can definitely bounce off each other that way.
Oh god, yeah. I was definitely, I felt like I was at 80% strength that whole playthrough just because of the diversion of attention and resources, you know what I mean?
The judgment from the Mount Pain 27.
Yeah. Which at that point, like, we're just, you know, because it's good. He and I have always just seen each other as peers from the moment we started talking, I think. We have this really good sort of, you know, we play off each other well.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've obviously done some stuff for his channel as well, which may be top secret, I'm not sure.
Oh, well. We'll just leave that there. We'll leave that document. We won't open that document. We'll leave it on the table.
Okay. People can think about that. They can ponder it.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit about sort of what you're working on now in terms of, I guess, like YouTube content as well as like WODs and community projects and stuff?
I have some playthroughs of some WODs that I've been wanting to do. Well, actually... I'll get into Doom content, like WOD related stuff first. There's still a bit of fixing up that needs to do with Jamal Jones before it can be released and finally be on id Games and I never have to think about it again. So, which will be fine. It's been really fun. I'm just joking. I've actually loved the whole thing, but I'm ready to be totally fixed and move on. And what I'm going to do after that is I'm going to spend probably a month on and off collecting all of the limit removing and vanilla WODs that have been released on Doomworld since my last big vanilla WOD pack update, because I want to get Jamal Jones in there. And there's been dozens of great vanilla and limit removing WODs this last year and a half or so, and I just want to make sure everything's there for the next update. And that is what I'll be focusing on this year, is getting the big vanilla WOD pack perfect. And I actually kind of want to do, I don't know if this will end up happening, so, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but I no pun intended there either. But I pretty much want to get a few physical, like, big box old sort of CD prints done of, like, the big vanilla WOD pack, like a D-Zone type thing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe get, like, 200 of them printed up, and the people who come and want one, you know, I can mail it out to them, they can... You know, just at the cost of like getting it made up and shipping it, nothing else. And so that's what I'm working on. That's like my plans for what I want to do content wise this year, as far as like WODs and making stuff for Doomers to play. As far as YouTube content goes, I just want to get back onto my, I've taken a few month break from my usual sort of let's playing of WODs. I really do want to get back into that. So I've definitely got that on the table as well.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. I think like Rowdy Rudy and Ray Mohawk, you know, could be like a double feature, you know, like package for that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of having like the cutout of Ray and Rudy, like on their respective title screens, like being on the left and right side of the front of the box. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And you can have the Doom guy side angle so they're looking at each other. It's perfect.
Yeah, exactly.
That sounds good. I really like the idea, actually, of having like a proper packaged version of that kind of thing. That's interesting.
And it'll be good too, because it's not like, I mean, like, I like D-Zone and all that shovelware and stuff, but it'll be good because there's actually a reasonable degree of quality control and representation of like the modern and the old. One thing I like about the WoD pack, just to waffle about that a little bit more, is it kind of feels like a follow-through line. Like, it's missing us, like all the Zedum and Boom stuff, which is just so plentiful. There's so much great stuff out there, and not to mention other formats as well. But you know, it feels like it's a history, it's a time capsule and a history thing, as well as just like being fun to play. Like, people who want to see how Doom has evolved over time can actually look at that through the like the date modified. I want to play a map from 94. They can play one or two maps from every year from the old days up till now, and literally see the culture of the community progress, the quality of the editors progress, like we were talking about before. So that's one thing that I really like. It feels like a historical capsule as well as a th that's one thing that I is sort of a goal of mine with the WoD pack.
Yeah, I mean, you seem like obviously someone who's interested in like Doom history and stuff like that, so makes sense to delve into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So to the final question, the big one, the very,
Oh.
very important question.
Oh, okay.
What is your favorite Doom monster and why?
My favorite Doom monster and why? You know what? I am gonna I don't know if anyone said this. I haven't listened to every episode. But although he can be annoying when used wrong, because he made me shit my britches, not literally, but well, I can claim that anyway. Whenever I was a kid, but E1M8, dude, the Barons, them going, ah, whenever you first see them and yelling like that, oh, there's that. That was nothing else. No other enemy quite had that same impact on me. So I'm gonna go with the Baron of Hell.
Wow, that's I don't think we've ever had Baron of Hell, actually. I think that's a first.
Wow, he's like the icon. The little dudes on the front of the Doom packaging are kind of meant to look barony. I thought, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah, I Archvile is definitely the most said, and then Revenant, I think, pretty close behind.
Yeah, well, that's reflected in mapping, wave after wave of those suckers.
Yeah, much to John Sweet Pea's chagrin. Yeah.
Sweet pea, poor sweet pea.
Yeah. So mostly for the aesthetic of that original map, do you think is why you like the Baron? Or from a gameplay perspective as well, do you enjoy them?
I do like them. I think if you've got like a plasma gun or rocket launcher, Barons are totally fun. Or even SSG, like a Baron or two can be fine. Hell Knights are great. Like, I consider them just the little brother of Baron. Like, they're kind of one and the same in a way, but in a crowd, Hell Knight's a better alternative, of course.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a Baron apologist, much like my TNT apologist badge. I'll put on my Baron apologist badge as well. I think they're pretty good, like in terms of slaughter and stuff. They're really good for pressure fights, and they're really good like intermingled with Hell Knights as like a surprise, like and an extra like I suppose threat that you have to prioritize because. If you have a Baron walking towards you and like a couple of Hell Knights, a lot of the time they act as this thing of like they bait you into wanting to deal with them, whereas like
Right.
you
That's
should be killing the Hell Knights because they die faster and
Yeah.
give you space quicker, but the Baron's scarier, so a lot of the time people will shoot the scarier one, you know.
That's one of the great dynamics with the interplay between Barons and Hell Knights. Your gut instinct wants to kill that Baron because you know he's a bigger threat technically, but no, that's a mistake. You just gotta have more green balls coming at you for longer if you do that.
Yeah, exactly. I wonder if it'd be interesting to change up that dynamic slightly and have it so that, you know, one of them is like less HP but higher damage or something. And then sort of keep them both at middling health but make one of them higher damage rolls or something like that. It might be more
Yeah.
interesting.
That would actually be cool. I would like to see that. It's not the exact same, but in Skulltag they had a even higher health version of the Baron. Not that much more actual HP though. But he walked a little faster and he threw like two or three balls real quick.
Yeah.
Like he went boom, 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 rather than doing the just one sort of medium speed one of the Baron. the Blefagor, I think he was called.
Those Belfagor, were, yeah, the red Belfagor, guy, right? Yes. I remember him, yeah.
Yes, yeah. No, I thought that was like, he was a little OP, I thought, but it was a cool thing. Him with the Hell Knight's health. Now, that would be a cool enemy. Maybe like a blue version where he was like all bright red. Make a bright blue Baron. Call him the like, well, they have to come up with some other sort of Baron sounding name. But yeah, I would like that. Like, you know, and it's funny, I kind of recreated that dynamic with the Rocket guys in Rowdy Rudy 2, actually. They're like slower, weaker Revenants. Mm-hmm. Like, they fire the same projectile, but sometimes I wanted to have like a similar threat to Revenants, but I didn't want to have, not that they're tanky at all. I mean, they're pretty low health, but I wanted to have something that was slightly lower threat, but still shooting those homing balls at you. So it was a good way, like, a place where you might put one or two Revenants, you can instead put three of these guys surrounding you, like in a wider, so you have to like scatter your shots more to take care of them all in due time. It's a fun way to do it. Yeah, I like having the like tougher and weaker versions of the same enemy. I thought that was really cool personally. I feel that way about the Shotgunner and Zombie Man, you know.
Well, Shotgunners are a crime usually.
Dude, I love them. The one I've made a few maps where I use them to be super mean in a similar way. I'm thinking of like E4 M1 and stuff when I'm placing them this way. But I remember, speaking of Mount Pain, the one map he liked the least in Rudy 1 was the one that was like super heavy on Shotgunners in like a Sigil / E4 M1 esque way. So yeah, I can see why most people think they are painful, but chuck a few medkit reserves here and there, and that can forgive the crime a bit, I suppose. Repentance for the sin.
Yeah, just thinking about this now, I feel like I should do a tier list for the Doom monsters in terms of how usable they are.
That would be a good video. You should do a video like that. I'd watch it. That sounds good.
Yep. Just if everyone donates $5,000, I will make a tier list. It'll be perfect.
All right. There we go. That's a reasonable. That's a reasonable goal.
No, it's a consideration, definitely. For free, most likely. I do think with custom monsters, though, generally lower health is the way to go. Like, if you look at a skill stalwart, I think he generally does a pretty good job of, like, keeping his health pools lower for his custom monsters, so they don't, you know, wear thin, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Skills, I mean, if you want, he's a prime example to look for if you want to see well-integrated, changed up versions of Doom monsters or slightly customized ones. He's definitely a good one to look to. He does it in a really he implements them super well. Yeah, he's really good at that.
Yeah, I agree. Well, yeah, I think that's the end. We got through the favorite monster question. It's the big one. A crazy answer too. Make sure you listen to the end. That's going to be in the title of this podcast, is clickbait, to hear the insane answer that you gave. I'm happy to hear Baron, though. I'm happy to hear anything but Archvile at this point, because it is it's everyone's favorite monster, I think.
I mean, I like them, but yeah, no, they're cool. Baron, dude, on the front cover of, I always thought that was a Baron doing that cheeky smile on the front cover of Doom. So that's part of why I feel like they're a bit of an icon of Doom as well, in the same way that Kakadi even is.
Yeah, I think it makes sense that you would choose something like that as someone who cares about kind of the
imagery and stuff, the theming and all that matters just as much as the actual content itself to me.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was a pleasure having you on. Thanks for agreeing to come on. And yeah, I will be back next week with another guest, and that will be...
It was really fun. I really enjoyed talking to you. I had a great time.
That's good. I'm glad. I'm glad that you felt comfortable and stuff, and we had a good chat. I feel like we got into the depths of the Raymer Hawk lore a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, yeah. Thanks again, and I'll see everybody next week. Bye. Thank you for listening. See you all.